Well, the important thing is that no one got hurt. Except for that guy. And those three.
I've never eaten a hot pocket and then afterwards been, I'm glad I ate that. I'm always like, I'm gonna die. I paid for that? Did I eat it or rub it on my face? My back hurts. Ow.
See, I have an inner ear problem. Sometimes I can't hear anything.
Not a fact?
Eh? Comedy's always been in my blood. The hepatitis is brand new, but the comedy's always been.
You know that metal plate in my head?
How can I forget?
I had to have it replaced. So over at the VA, they had to replace it with a plastic one. It ain't strong, so... I don't know if I ought to go sailing down no hill with nothing between the ground of my brain but a piece of government plastic.
You really think it matters, Eddie?
One of my favorite movies around the season, around the holiday season, of course, is Christmas Vacation. That was a great scene from that. Pierre Bork sitting in for Rob Snow in the afternoon edition. This is Wednesday, so that means house call, and Dr. Barry Dworkin in the studios. Hello, Barry.
Hi, how you doing?
Awesome day. Good to have you in here. You're
Thank
looking
you.
Fit as a fiddle.
Thank you.
And we are taking your calls as well, 613-521-8255, star 580 on the Bell Mobility, and 1-800-580-2372. This hour is devoted to you and your concerns. Barry, I just want to start it off while we're waiting for a few calls to come in. The American election last week, the U.S. election, the states of Colorado and Washington starting to lean towards marijuana. They're saying, hey, you know, it's not so big a deal. Do you see that coming into Canada? And from your perspective, medicinally, from a medical perspective, is it something that's long overdue or is it something we should be shying away from?
There is a lot of evidence that using cannabis will help alleviate a lot of chronic pain states. There are some of my patients that have been using it, and it does work. The issue becomes one of medicinal use, but also when you look at the actual harms from using a particular drug, you know, you don't have that much evidence that cannabis does a horrible amount of harm to people compared to some of the stuff that's out there now. Alcohol and cigarettes being a great example of addiction problems. You know, so if you're talking about cannabis and how people use it and the fact that, let's face it, Pierre, there are millions of people in Canada that use it. You know, you don't see the same disease processes. You don't see the same social problems when people are using it moderately. Light to moderately. As with any drug, if you use it too much and too often, yes, you will see problems. So chronic cannabis users, you tend to see a lot of problems, memory impairments, reduced motivation, you know, and again, but you cannot lump everybody together in one group. You're always going to have outliers. But the point is that other areas of the world have legalized it. And you don't see the same kind of problems. Some people will say, hey, it's a gateway to something. Well, lots of things can be gateways. But again, people are using this anyway. And you're criminalizing people. You're sending people to jail. For what? What are you actually trying to accomplish?
Now, tobacco is legal, but controlled.
Right.
To a certain degree. Alcohol is legal and controlled to a certain degree.
Correct.
If you throw cannabis into the mix, if you had to say which of in order of, you know, more concern, greater concern, if you will, or worse, greater harm, yes.
Yeah.
Which of the three, how would you rate them in order of worst to least of those three?
Well, because of the different diseases they cause, I would say if you look at stats-wise in terms of cancers, probably cigarettes, alcohol, and then cannabis would be at the bottom of the list and probably way at the bottom. You know, it's just not the same kind of harm. Sure, if you're smoking cannabis, you are going to get some smoke effect on your lung, but you're not smoking as much as you would smoke cigarettes in terms of number of cigarettes a day.
And what if you throw fast food and soft drinks into
that mix? Well, yeah, you know, that's the thing. So you have to be dispassionate about this. People will have very strong opinions. I like to look at evidence for things. We have evidence that prohibition does not work. Interdiction does not work. For this particular drug, I'm not talking about cocaine. I'm not talking about heroin. I'm not talking about any of those other drugs. Although, you know, narcotic medications is another thing that we would get into another discussion about providing it to people as opposed to obtaining it illegally. Because someone that is taking a narcotic on a regular basis can function completely normally. It's the procurement that tends to cause the harm to people. So when you look at these drugs, we have to look at real data and not just go with the gut reaction that we have with regards to drug use.
So those in need, those who have a medicinal need for it as opposed to a recreational need for it, they have access to it through the medical community.
You can, although there's still some hesitation. There's a lot of paperwork to do. Frankly, a lot of physicians will say to their patients, "Just go and buy some."
Is the product as good? Exactly where I was going here is: is the product as good through legal means as it might be by going to the nearby high school or one of the back alleys in the Byward Market?
Well, I think that the answer to that would be get a sample of both and take multiple samples and compare them to see what the differences are. But if you're just getting the pure plant, the only thing different might be the potency of the drug.
Yeah.
You know, and what's in and you know what they use to prevent any breakdown or, you know, make sure there's no additives or things that they put in there. But otherwise, it does help people who have chronic pain, who have cancer pain, where other medications have not worked as well. People that are having chronic pain syndromes are not using it to get high, they're using it to prevent their pain. So, you know, I think we have to be reasonable about this. I think there tends to be an overreaction to the particular drug, and we ignore, as we just mentioned, the effects of other compounds and substances that we consume on a daily basis that cause much more harm than cannabis does.
You know, it's funny, in the aftermath of the election last week, one of the American channels was doing, TV channels was doing an interview with somebody selling marijuana in Colorado, now legal. And he was showing some of his produce or his product, if you will, a huge variety of them. It was like walking into a candy store. That is much more than a medicinal need. That is certainly people who are trying them the way you might try a variety of beers.
Yeah, but you know, but that's it. People will choose their poison, so to speak. And choosing cannabis as opposed to getting drunk, you're not going to do as much harm by smoking up than you will by drinking. There's a huge difference on the effect on your body. So I'm just saying we have to have a rational discussion about it and not take these polarized opposites and think that it's a black and white issue. It's not a black and white issue.
And maybe that time has come now
I would hope it gets to that point, because the evidence that we have so far does not bode well for interdiction. It just does not work.
All right, good. All right, so we are taking your call, 613-521-8255, *580 on the Bell Mobility, and 1-800-580-2372. Our first call is Mark. Mark, where are you calling from?
Ottawa.
How are you? What part of Ottawa?
Barrhaven.
All right, Barrhaven. And you'd like to speak to Dr. Barry? He's right here.
Yeah, first time caller, long time listener to your show.
Thanks.
Our daughter, who is 9,
about
a year and a half ago, started suffering. We didn't recognize the symptoms at the time. It was just this summer from, we believe, anxiety. Now, we've had a referral from the family physician to a child physician.
Okay.
A local doctor here. And there were stomach pain issues that were going on, and it all ties into the anxiety. About a week and a half ago, they put her on Ciprolax 10 milligrams, and it has made a difference in the, she had over the top reactions due to panic, I guess you could say, or anxiety. And it's working, but she seems to be falling back into the old habits. What's next, I guess, would be the question.
How old is she?
9.
Wow. Usually the way I would approach something like that is, you know, has she had this anxiety before, or is this something new?
It's new. It started about a year and a half ago, but this summer it really, like, you know, the fear of going on a trip for bathrooms, the fear of looking back when someone suggests, you know, maybe it's anxiety, and we started looking down that path.
Is there a family history of anxiety at all?
No.
Okay, so usually, you know, the important thing is that if this is something that has happened relatively recently, there usually are triggers for anxiety. It just doesn't come out of the blue. And medications alone are unlikely to fix the problem, especially if she's never really exhibited this before. And it's something that has, as you mentioned, started recently. There could have been some trauma that she hasn't told you about or has been afraid to discuss, something she may have seen. The ideal thing to do is to have, there are child psychology specialists in the city.
Well, that's what she's seeing.
That's good, because that's ultimately where you're going to get your answer, where she feels comfortable to talk, where she feels comfortable to express what she's afraid of and why she's afraid of it. Because unless that is determined, there isn't going to be any medications that's going to fix this problem. This is the way to approach this is usually it's called cognitive behavioral therapy, but in children they do this a bit differently. But ultimately, there is something that happened that has caused her to feel this way. It just doesn't really happen out of the blue, especially with no family history of anxiety.
So, well, Barry, you're saying here that short of the medicine here, that it may well be something that if she can be coaxed into talking in a comfort level, that she feels the ability to divulge what it is that is her concern, that if that she gets that off of her chest, it may be the solution.
It's the beginning of something. Mark, you were saying something about...
Yeah, well, we're not totally convinced it is anxiety, yeah. but... The stomach issues, the fears of this, the fears of that. Plus, there's been 2 years of school issues as well that have been ongoing at school. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so,
she got suspended today. She's 9.
Yeah. And when you have some what we call somatic issues, that is physical ailments associated with that, she's obviously stressed out over something.
Tums. Right? Going through tums like there was nothing for the last 6 months.
So there is something going on. Obviously something going on recently and just the underlying factor is not yet known. So the best thing is to continue to support her and to provide an environment where she feels able to talk. But ultimately she is going to need that extra bit of counseling and help to allow her to open up. 9 years old, it's hard for them to even express themselves well with some of the complex things they may be dealing with. So they have techniques to get them to describe this. But ultimately, the medication Ciprolex in a 9-year-old, not much evidence that it's going to do too much. And ultimately, as you mentioned, if it's going to work, it takes 4 to 6 weeks at least. And really,
it has to be the difference. The reactions, the anxiety, stressful reactions have diminished at the high peak level. The same person is there with the same response without the high peak level and loss of complete control of the ability to control the outburst, you know what I mean?
Right, but if the underlying trigger is still there or it's not being rectified, she's going to continue to have these reactions. And so I think you're doing the right thing by having her see that specialist.
All right, Mark, it's a serious situation you're in, and we thank you for sharing it, but we also hope that that the child psychologist and some of the other people that you might be able to lean on will help your daughter open up, and hopefully ultimately
they usually do very good work to help in the right direction. In those situations.
All right, you're listening to Wednesday House Call. Dr. Barry Dworkin in the house with us. Pierre Bork sitting in for Rob Snow.
It's like some 14-year-old kid skateboarding up to me, talking to me about lung cancer, you know? Hey, man. Notice you're smoking a cigarette, buddy. Can I talk to you about lung cancer? You smell like pot right now. No. Yeah, are you a doctor? Is this what doctors look like? They ride skateboards around, they wear Arcade Fire t-shirts, is that what's happening? Do doctors go see where the wild things are at 1 o'clock in the afternoon?
Yeah, I think that's it. That's pretty funny. 3:39 on 580 CFRA. Pierre Bork on the Wednesday afternoon edition for Rob Snow. Rob, as I'll remind you, is on every morning this week, sitting in for Lowell Green from 10 until noon. And I'm here in his seat all through this week, each afternoon from 3 to 6. This hour, of course, Barry Dworkin with us for the house call. Barry, during the break here a moment ago, we were talking about food.
Yeah.
And you wanted to relay a story about people and sort of a social habit of what happens when you get to a vast array of edible foods in front of you and what happens.
Well, it's very interesting when you look at the behavior. There's a lot of studies done, especially by Dr. Brian Wansink. He wrote a book called Mindless Eating, Why You Eat More Than You Think. He's the director of the Food and Brand Lab at Cornell University. And the idea is that it is not just hunger that dictates how much you eat. It's the visual cues and the environment within which you find yourself that will contribute to your patterns of eating. So for example, Pierre, if you were sitting here alone and eating a meal, we would call that your baseline, okay, of the certain amount of food that you would eat. If you were eating with one other person, you would consume 25% more food than you normally would. And it's repeatable over and over again. If you are with a group of people, about six or more with a group of people, which is very common, people go out to restaurants, they sit around the table, you will consume 100% more food than you would if you were just sitting here alone. And part of the reason is people don't like to see another person sitting and eating by themselves. Another is you're busy talking and food keeps coming to the table, bread keeps coming to the table, drinks are being ordered, and you just keep going and going and going because it's a social thing to be doing. And so you see this linear graph that he did with hundreds and hundreds of people showing that kind of behavior. Same thing with buffets. When you are presented with a very small, say you go to a buffet and there are four choices, right? You'll choose certain things and that'll be it.
And usually at a buffet, it really is a veritable smorgasbord. Yeah. You've got a variety, a huge variety.
So when you go to this huge buffet, you're going to try almost everything.
Yeah.
And you'll go for multiple plates and go, oh, I got to try that. Oh, I got to try that. And it doesn't matter how full you feel. You're going to keep going for stuff. I remember there was one instance, this was a long time ago. I'd say this is now over 40, no, but 35 years ago. We went, it was in the U.S. I was heading with my mom. We were just going to Plattsburgh or something in New York. And we stopped by this restaurant and they have this dairy bar buffet. So you can make your own sundaes and such. And I'm watching people, how they're, what they're doing. And the size of the, let's say your food containing unit is going to dictate how much you choose. So if you take a small glass or a small parfait cup, you'll just fill it up and that'll be it. If you take a large one, you're going to fill that up too. You're going to use all the volume available. So in this case, there was this lady who really didn't have to go to the dairy bar, so to speak.
A polite way to say the last thing she needed was dairy bar calories.
And I'm watching her and she fills in she does a base of ice cream and then I still see the image today. She fills up the ice cream first, chocolate syrup, ice cream, chocolate syrup, ice cream, nuts, cherry on top, whipped cream. And then she's literally holding up the glass. Like, you know how sometimes you look at wine after you just pour it just to see, you know, you're looking at the texture and stuff. So she's looking at it and then she looks from side to side to see if anybody's watching her. And she takes her hand and she squashes everything in the glass down tighter. And then she puts more whipped cream on top.
Oh my gosh. That is fantastic.
I couldn't believe it.
If you're 6 years old, that sounds like a little piece of heaven.
But that illustrated how, again, just the behavior of I can pack it in more and put more in and it still looks the same, but you're just getting more food into you when you don't need it.
I should mention that we're taking calls, 613-521-8255, *580 on the Bell Mobility. And if you're calling long distance, 1-800-580-2372. A number of people, increasingly, I am learning, are gluten intolerant, and they've gone through a personal battle to determine what it is that has caused them to have issues with gluten. And to a certain degree, you're starting to see the food industry reacting to that and starting to either provide options that are gluten-free, or in certain restaurants, you might have gluten-free menus and what have you. How much of that do you see in your practice, people coming in say, hey, you know, I've got the issues here, and it turns out to be something like that?
It's actually not very common to have what we call a gluten enteropathy or celiac disease. It is certainly are people that suffer with it. There's a very specific way to diagnose it. I think what's happening is it's becoming the disease du jour, and people think that they have something like that as a means of explaining why their bowel hurts or why when they eat certain things they may have an upset stomach. But until you are tested, and there are specific blood tests that look for a particular enzyme and antibodies, and there's biopsies that can be done, which will readily diagnose the condition. Sometimes what people do is that they will food restrict and they feel better, but they make a false association because they've restricted so many foods that they may have restricted the compound that they're sensitive to, but it's not necessarily gluten.
What causes somebody to have a gluten allergy or be a celiac?
It's an inherited condition.
Yeah.
So you'll see it run in families. I remember I had a family from Norway that was here for a while, and all of them had celiac. And we tested the children because the parents and the older siblings had it, and they too had celiac. So there is a heavily genetic component to it. But nevertheless, it is not rampant. It's not a disease that's rampant. Most people don't have it. And you'll have some people that'll call up and say, well, I thought I had it and I did have it. Yeah, but
What is it? It's an allergy to wheat?
It's an intolerance to digest gluten. So you end up with cramps and bloating and gas.
And where is gluten prevalent?
It's in wheat products, primarily wheat products. So that's why you have to, you know, you have to buy products that are gluten-free. And so it's good that companies are making these things for people that truly suffer from this because the restrictions were really quite a burden on people. But I think there's too many people jumping the gun to say, I have a gluten enteropathy.
But if they're able to be diagnosed as such, it's got to be fantastic today that they have such a variety of options for food.
Absolutely. But in terms of the numbers, I think it's being misrepresented in terms of the number of people that are being affected.
Right. Well, let's see how that story evolves. Tim in Smith Falls on the line. Hello, Tim. You have a question for Dr. Barry.
Sure. How are you guys today?
Fine, thanks.
Great. I have a question about chronic fatigue. No matter how much sleep I get, I just seem to be always tired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've gone to a sleep clinic, and they said, well, you've got mild restless leg syndrome, but, you know, I had surgery on my throat for snoring. That seems to have improved that, but there's really been no change in this fatigue feeling. And the more I talk to people, the more it seems prevalent that everybody is chronically tired. You know, what can you tell me about that?
Well, you've opened up a big can of worms, Tim, because chronic fatigue is the end result of something that obviously leads to it. And so you've mentioned a few things, you know, sleep apnea or sleep disorders. It can also be the result of the environment that we find ourselves in. The you know, our sleep cycles, how much they are interrupted with. Various diseases can contribute to that. Thyroid diseases, low testosterone levels, various other hormonal imbalances, diabetes, people who smoke, cardiac disease, renal disease, lung disease. So as you can see, the list is really quite broad in terms of what can contribute to fatigue. And ultimately, what is important to do is, I find that 90% of the time you can determine a person's diagnosis just by talking to them and asking them all the questions relating to each of the issues I've discussed. Because you're absolutely correct that fatigue is a significant problem in our society. Most of it happens because of, I find, where people are working, the demands that are being put on them, the sometimes impossible demands. There are people that now find themselves in situations where staff is being laid off and they're taking up more slack and they have to work harder and they're not being rewarded for it. And there's just more pressure put on them. So, and that's not to say that's the only reason, but the point is that our environment in and of itself contributes to people being overly tired. There's no off time anymore in our society. And that's part of the issue.
Barry, let me ask you this. The pace of society, the pace of life increases. And worries about life, worries about making ends meet, worried about keeping a job, worried about whatever. That keeps growing. Is there a mental fatigue versus, say, 100 years ago? And maybe I should be saying 200 years ago, but when physical labor was so much part of your daily activity that you were physically tired, has all of the modern conveniences that help you with physical tiredness is now giving you a mental tiredness?
You raise a very important point because, you know, 100 years ago, people went to bed when it got dark.
Yeah.
Right? And so it was more of an agrarian society at that time. And so you followed the sun, so to speak. And your brain is wired like that. Our brains are conditioned to be awake during the daytime and sleep when it's dark. And today, you have night shifts. You have 24-hour restaurants, 24-hour drugstores, 24-hour of everything. People are awake when they shouldn't be awake. And over time, certainly you can deal with that on a you know, time-to-time basis, intermittent basis. But when it becomes a fixture in your life or where we adapt, people tend to adapt to changes very slowly. And when you look back over 1, 2, 10 years and you say, what am I doing now? What was I doing 10 years ago? What has changed? And usually there's a huge change in what has happened in their lives that leads them to those, you know, the fatigue and the other problems that you see. There is absolutely a reason why that happens. And part of it also is we don't have, and a lot of people don't have the opportunity to develop the coping tools or to step back and step out of the box and say, this is what's causing the problem. A lot of times they feel trapped because they have to earn a living, they have to pay their bills, and they're on this treadmill and they can't get out of it. that also contributes to the problem.
Yeah, it's like going out for the evening in a different way, going out for an evening and having a very stimulating evening. We've gone to the circus, you've gone to a concert, whatever it is, you come back, you're wired for sound, to use the vernacular.
Yeah.
It's tough to go to sleep right away.
But if it's done once in a while, no big deal.
Yep.
But you have, again, you see people who have shift work, they have a preponderance of illnesses, a lot more illnesses and problems than people that have normal hours that don't change.
In a hospital setting where you do have people working shifts, you have your colleagues in your profession, nurses as well, orderlies, whatever, they're all working. How do they stay as vibrant as they need to be in very, very unique situations?
Well, I'll tell you, I have a lot of nurses in my practice, and they aren't doing well. They're burning out. The shift work literally kills them. They really can't. With the cutbacks that they've experienced, the workloads, the patient demands, the number of patients they have to care for, they're not healthy. They can't keep, and they're retiring and they're stopping early because they burn out.
I find it fascinating. Dr. Barry Dworkin, just a reminder, he's here every Wednesday. He's all ours for a full hour and yours as well, because you can call in and throw anything you want at him. So, Barry, thank you very much for being here today.
You're very welcome, Pierre.
And it's very fascinating to me that your own profession suffers from shift work. And of course, you have to be aware of that. You're back on Sunday.
I think I'm back this Sunday. I think there's a hockey game this Sunday.
Generally,
Sunday afternoons, but definitely the Sunday after.
All right, Barry. Thank you very much for joining us.